Hello, hello, hello. Hello, Georgians, hello, global citizens, and hello, concerned Americans. My name is Varun Kadathala, and I'm the current co-host of the Politician Podcast, which myself and my high school best friend Damian Galvin created in June of this year to talk about issues that interest us, issues that disgust us, and issues that America needs to know about. In other words, myself and Damian created this podcast to deconstruct public policy issues of the past and the present and create a more equitable future for all of us. We have a very, very special episode queued up for you guys, but before we play this episode, we're going to give a special thank you to our sponsor, Patreon, and our wonderful team here at Politician, which includes high school juniors Jada Pilling, Yi Shen, and Julia Hartman. Thank you guys so much for listening to this episode, and we hope that you enjoy. See you in the episode.
And we're rolling. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Politician. My name is Damian Galvin, and as always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Varun.
Hey guys, my name is Varun Kadathala. I'm the co-host of your Politician podcast, where myself and my high school best friend, Damian Galvin, deconstruct public policy issues of the past and the current to create a more beneficial future for everybody. Now, today we have a very special guest on our podcast, as always. His name is William Hughes, and he's a candidate for the Georgia House of Representatives. Now, William, we're so excited to have you on today. If you'd like to introduce yourself for all of our guests, our viewers today.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm happy to be here. I heard about you guys from Charles Ravenscraft. He's running over there in House District 22. We're district neighbors, I guess. And just a little background on me. I'm an engineer. I work on control systems for, right now it's mostly chemical plants, but I've worked on everything from Air Force wind tunnels to power plants and paper mills. So that's kind of my professional background. I'm married with two kids, and they are doing distance learning right now in Cherokee County. So that's a interesting experience. I know everybody shifted to it at the end of the spring last year.
Yeah.
But it's been challenging. And kind of my non-work, non-politics, non-family kind of passion has been martial arts. And I missed out on it for quite a while. When I first got into work, I started doing karate and got up to a black belt. And then I moved down here and couldn't find I'll admit I wasn't looking, but didn't find a place to pick it up at. I had a lot else going on, getting married, having kids and stuff. But my daughter started Taekwondo, and I picked up at a school here. And I'm actually, when COVID is all over, I'm gonna be an instructor again, doing, you know, still being a student. So as far as my entry into politics goes, spent years arguing politics on the internet with people, and I guess honing my ability to kind of listen, which is really something that we don't get taught a lot, is how to listen. And in college, they were like, I was in a group of people, and we had to focus on kind of developing ourselves and all this, you know, it sounds very hippie, and talked about listening. And I sort of practiced it, not really well, but as time went on and I got older and older, that was kind of where I ended up. And I feel comfortable these days in discussing with people different viewpoints and kind of coming to understand their viewpoint, and maybe understand that we're not enemies, and it's not so much I'm right, you're wrong, as it is we just have really different life experiences, really different people that we know, and they have different life experiences that color ours and all that kind of thing. So toward the end of last year, I got a text from a Democratic organization, I can't remember, maybe Move On, asking if I had ever considered running for office. And I told them, sure, I had, because you start talking about this stuff, you're like, I could do better than that. But it's not so much I can do better than that as I feel like I might be ready to give it a shot and to try and help out. And that's how I got to here.
Yeah, I think it's an extremely interesting story. And I think something interesting that I found was I also did a Taekwondo, And I think that martial arts does teach you a little bit as well, a little bit more than I think you'd expect about politics, more particularly, you know, that patience and that respect towards others. And, you know, if we want to talk about debating online, I think that's kind of why we started this podcast. We wanted to kind of shift away from that, and we wanted to have more of a conversation about these issues as opposed to just having arguments that you can't really have when you're on social media. I think that it's important to have conversations. And like I said, that's why we really started this podcast. And I think that beyond that, I think that you're doing something great in going into politics and using your platform and using your experience. And I think that as we understand your experience, we can understand you a little bit more.
I agree with that.
Absolutely. So on the topic of distance learning, I saw you brought it up. Your kids are in distance learning, as you said. Now, first of all, I want to bring the topic of Cherokee County, because that county is really, really in a mess right now with the cold COVID situation going on. I've seen pictures, Mr. Hughes, I've seen pictures of your county, and it's absolutely insane the amount of scrutiny they've been getting in terms of what they've been doing, because they have not been restricting people. It's been completely open, no mask mandate, and not distance whatsoever. So the question I have for you is what do you think about online learning specifically? Because I know there's been different viewpoints about that and how it should be done. With, you know, Damien is taking online learning for most of his periods, and I'm taking all in-person learning in Forsyth County. So Damien definitely has some viewpoints about that. But I wanted to gauge what you think we should all do for online learning, because sometimes I think the issue is that there's really not an opportunity for kids to learn or ask questions. It's more of just complete this assignment and turn it in and have this test. It's not as interactive. So what do you think we can do to improve it? And second of all, what do you think about how Cherokee County, your county, is handling the situation?
It was very interesting switching over to distance learning at the end of last spring.
Yeah.
They had, my understanding is the Cherokee County had been kind of developing a distance learning strategy as not for COVID or anything. They were just aware of the fact that there are times where it's going to be better. And yeah. The what I've heard as we've moved back into distance learning in the fall is that it was also sort of developed as a remedial tool and a kind of catch-up tool. And so what you would end up doing is you'd give the student, here's what you need to do to catch up. And it just needs to be completed by this time. But what ended up happening when they started back this fall was that the kids would get, you know, this is what we're going to try and get done this week. And then without us being like right over the shoulder and without maybe that even being clearly conveyed to the students, my daughter was basically running from 8 a.m. until 6 p.m. doing schoolwork. And it turned out that she was basically doing a week's worth of schoolwork in a day or yeah. something like that. And, you know, obviously they were like, oh, well, maybe we need to go back to the drawing board a little bit and try and figure out how to convey to the kids that they shouldn't be doing the whole week. I do feel like there's not as, I don't hear as much interaction, I guess, between my kids and their teachers. But a part of me wonders if that's because if I were in the classroom, what it would be is Charlie is asking the teacher a question, the teacher answers the question, and then Lucy asks a question and the teacher answers a question. And then eventually my daughter answered, you know, and it would have that if I were on line with her on the Zoom call or whatever they're using, I would hear all that interaction. And so, you know, that's actually, it's something I thought of today. So I haven't had a chance to ask my kids about it, but my guess is that if it were some sort of tutor one-on-one thing, that they would just be going back and forth, back and forth. And so that would, so it might not be, and maybe Damien can let us know about that part of it. As far as yeah. Cherokee County goes, I'm really disappointed in the leadership of the county and a lot of my neighbors. I know that it's not because they're bad people that want to infect everyone. It's because they believe that COVID-19 is not as easy to transmit as we know that it is from looking at all the data. They believe that it's not as deadly as it is, that we know from all the data. They've got these ideas about how kids may or may not get it, you know, like, no,
yeah,
you're immune to disease until you turn 18, you know, something like that.
Once you can vote, you can you can get the disease.
Right. That'd be great. That'd be great. I'd sign up for that.
I think that what's my situation is a little bit different because my whole county didn't switch to online learning. I will tell you, being a student here in Forsyth and doing it, it is extremely lonely. I mean, you don't have a Zoom call or anything. At most, I'll get is I'll get to FaceTime one friend that I have one class with. You're not interacting with the teacher at all. The only teacher that I've talked to that I've heard their voice this year in any sense where we can have a communication back and forth is my in-person teacher. So that's why it's different here in Forsyth County. But I think that, you know, I even talked to my parents about it. I'm like, yeah, they'll be like, it's not that bad. Come on. Like, you don't have to feel bad about it. Because at the end of the day, I mean, we can say whatever we want about it. It's depressing to have to be sitting here, you know, with the computer screen alone. But, you know, they're like, oh, it's not that bad. Come on. Your cousin in this other county is doing it. I'm like, yeah, but the whole county is doing it. So they get to at least there's a sense of unity on that front. And they don't feel alone in it. It's nice to be able to do all your schoolwork in one day, though, and kind of have the rest of the week off. I won't deny. I do that. I just get it all done in one day and I'm like, oh, okay, I'm off for the rest of the week.
Don't tell anybody.
I won't. But if Dr. Bearden's listening to this podcast, we didn't say anything. Speaking of leadership here in Forsyth County, we did have the superintendent on, and yeah, I can 1,000% relate to what you're saying. They're not bad people, and they don't have bad or malicious intentions whatsoever. They have a different viewpoint on the facts, which is weird to say. They have a different interpretation of the data, which, I mean, today is common. But I think that it's more so the fact that it's become political. That's the issue. We saw, you know, here in Forsyth County, we saw a Betsy DeVos come to Forsyth Central, and me and Varun have been talking about it and talking about it and talking about it, and it was complete BS.
And that's one of our high schools.
It's complete BS. And it's BS right. because it was misportrayed, and many students complain about it, saying that this isn't what a normal day is like. Normally, we aren't as distanced. The hallways are more crowded, and not as many students are wearing masks. But for, you know, Betsy DeVos, everyone was like, put on a mask, you know, look pretty, and portray it in that way. So I think that's where the anger in the leadership is coming from, and I can understand it. Another thing is, and something that I've still not understood, is the fact that Cherokee County has acknowledged, and you even said it, that they acknowledge the fact that the virus is ever changing, and therefore we have to adapt. And so Dr. Bearden talked about how his plan was proposed at the end of July, if I'm not mistaken, Varun. And he said to go back and change that plan would be detrimental to the, you know, the making of the schedules of the students. It would be detrimental to how we teach if we went back and changed that plan. And I asked him, but is it not true that the virus is ever changing? Don't we have to adapt the guidelines that we follow to the ever-changing virus? And again, the answer to the question was, we can't change them because we already put them in place and they were already voted on, which upset me, to say the least.
Yeah, there's a strong commitment in our governing institutions and kind of even the appointed officials to following the normal path or to act in a way that accords with the way that they've always done it. And that ties into, well, we made rules that say you can't just change the way that the school year is going to execute because someone, you know, a long time ago, they were like, well, should we be able to change the way the school year is going to execute if we decide that that's a good idea? So, oh, no, we couldn't do that. Certainly couldn't do that by the superintendent alone. We would have to bring the school board in. We would have to have a vote. And we'd have to have public comment. And these days, you get a lot of public comment on just about anything that any governing authority is going to do. And it's a lot of the time, it's very, people come to it spoiling for a fight. They don't come to it wanting to have an exchange of ideas or listen to the concerns that other people might have. I mean, there have been schools that have, they went in person, they started their classes up, everybody sort of got into a rhythm, and then, you know, 7 to 10 to 14 days, however long the incubation period for COVID is, they started getting cases. And then they started getting like, oh, wow, this is a lot of cases. We're going to, let's stop and everybody go to distance learning, right? Well, I don't know about you, but I feel like this cycle that we're almost certainly going to be going in, because we're only 3 or 4 weeks into the school year, depending on the school system, is going to be go to school, cases spike. They get to some point that I think they have guidelines for the number of point of cases and number of quarantines and all that kind of thing, to where it's like, well, it's foolish to keep school open. Let's go distance learning. We'll wipe everything down with Clorox for 2 weeks. And there's a day of transition to distance learning and all this kind of stuff. And then come right back and wait for the cases to spike again. And then everybody has to go back to distance learning. And it's just this, it's going to be this cycle. And what's either going to happen is they're going to say, well, we'll just deal with however many COVID cases there are. We could have the whole school with COVID. And we're just going to power on through because that's what our constituents have told us to do when they showed up to the school board meeting and yelled at us and held signs and said, that's my right to not wear a mask or whatever. And the disappointing thing for me is that these people in charge are supposed to be in charge. They're not supposed to just do what the people tell them to do. They're supposed to listen to what the people say, look at the facts, look at the advice that they get from experts in these things, and come to a reasoned decision that they think collects both what their constituents want and what is best for their constituents. And they're just skipping that part about what's best for your constituent. They're skipping the part about, hey, there are 50,000 students who can't vote in Cherokee County and won't be able to vote. Some of them won't be able to vote for 15 years, you know, or 13 years, who they're making decisions that affect their life. And we know that this thing, you know, damages your lungs and damages organ systems in unpredictable ways. And they're making decisions for those people, for those children, who have no vote and have no way to control the people in charge. And they're just like, well, your parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles and business owners, and they want you all to go to school. So that's what we're going to do. And that's not leadership. That's just, that's like following in reverse almost.
Yeah. We talked to Dr. Bearden, and Dr. Bearden had a great interview with Plotatine, our superintendent, that is. And I pushed him on the point that, you know, you're saying you're supporting kids who are homeless, have mental disabilities, special education needs, and want them to go to school. But the problem is that you're not keeping schools sustainable if you don't have a mask mandate. And they're going to be at risk once again once schools close down because of no mask mandate. And the fact of the matter is that the kids that he said wouldn't be able to go to school because they had to wear masks with asthma would be the same kids with the worst effects if they had the coronavirus. That's the biggest issue I think that we're dealing with right now in our county. Yeah. Now, I think the beyond learning, it has to go down to COVID-19 in our community, our county. I think that the way Georgia's handling COVID-19 is unacceptable by any means and from any standpoint. I think we have to make change. And I think that we have to have more rapid testing. We should have mask mandates in, I think, cities, big cities, the whole state. We have to take leadership on this issue, because that's the only way we can stop this virus and hopefully return to normal. But I think that it also comes down to a national response, because we're having people from Alabama come to Georgia, people from other states come to Georgia. It's not going to stop at just Georgia. So as a person who may be elected to represent Georgia and the House of Representatives for our state, what do you think we have to advocate for in terms of policy to get rid of this virus and a really hard line restrictions upon people gathering and really meeting up and spreading this virus? What do you think is the decision here to make?
I think the best approach for us, we like to maintain our kind of rural state identity. And, you know, it's a thing that I really like about living in Georgia, living in Cherokee County, especially outside of Atlanta, is that we do have kind of that more laid back, slower approach to life where it's not just this hustle and bustle, but that's not who we actually are. We're actually, even in Cherokee County and Forsyth County, we're still metropolitan-ish counties. We've got lots of people coming in and out of the counties, doing business, starting businesses, you know, going to restaurants. There's all kinds of activities. You can go hiking. There's so much stuff that you can do. And a lot of it means being around other people. And this virus thrives on other people being around other people, especially if they're coming from different areas. And we have great penetration of our transportation, or, you know, cars at least, transportation systems around the area where we can, you know, you can live on one side of the city and drive to work on the other side of the city. And then when you want to go for some nightlife, you go downtown, you go somewhere else, and people are just gathering and gathering, and they're getting the message from their governments and their elected officials and even some appointed people probably responding to what the elected officials are saying. It's, you know, you don't want to catch COVID, but you should do what you think is best. And it's not going to be enough. And we should be looking at places like California, or not California, like New York City, especially New York City, where they said, look, we've got this thing and it's going wild fire up here. We need to go hardcore, close all the bars and restaurants. We need to do a mask mandate. We need to do social distancing mandate. We can have fines that we actually assign to people for violating the mask mandate. So not just we have a mask mandate and it's a $2,000 fine if you don't follow it, and then no one gets a ticket, because that's not really a mandate. So it's a challenge for them to try to, I don't know, I feel like they're tied up in their potential national just they want to look good to the national Republican Party. They want to look good to Fox News. They want to look good to certain groups and commercial interests who have no, they don't care at all what happens to the people of Georgia. They care about putting forward and advancing their goals. And it's depressing. But what we should be doing is mask mandate. The way that it is right now, if you look at on Reddit, they've got a coronavirus GA sub and a guy who's doing a great job in 4BFR keeping up the data. And we're worse now than we were like at any point, basically.
Yeah.
Even at the beginning, when we had the shelter in place order, it's going to be terrible. We need to have a shelter in place again, and it's going to be the worst. And we need to have a mask mandate, and that's going to make people upset. And we need to have social distancing. We need to close all the bars and restaurants to make them carry out only. It's going to be terrible, because this is what happens when you don't do the work ahead of time.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of to pivot a little bit here, we were talking about transportation and, you know, transportation between cities and communities here, and something that we can't deny here in Forsyth County. And as I have looked in surrounding areas to kind of compare these facts, it's the fact that we have a lack of public transportation. And in that lack of public transportation, we miss a lot of opportunity for cultural diversity. And that's something that's a discussion that's, you know, unfortunately, we can't avoid today. And I say unfortunately because it would be wonderful to not have to talk about cultural diversity, because we already have it. But, you know, in these communities and in Georgia, you know, we've seen a lack of cultural diversity, but particularly throughout the United States with the events that preceded this weekend and earlier this year. It's a conversation that we can't necessarily avoid. I think that, you know, I was writing to one of my representatives earlier today, and in writing to him, I might just even pull up the email. I brought up points that I think were crucial for advocation. Firstly, and my first point is this. It's the fact that there's been deep-rooted racism in at least I can't speak for Cherokee County because I haven't done the adequate research to speak for it. But in Forsyth County, there has been deep-rooted racism that drove out minorities. And while it may not be deep-rooted today, in the sense that we're not driving out minorities today, blatantly, you know, we don't have signs that say white tenants only. We don't have guys in hoods walking around, burning crosses on, you know, African-American tenants' lawns. It might not be that in the same sense, but I believe that a lack of acknowledgement that this once happened in our past is attributing to them not feeling welcome. Once we acknowledge, you know, I was quoted here as saying, to this, we must not deny the facts, but rather acknowledge the pain. And in this, you know, event that we're hoping to have here, we must acknowledge that. Secondly, as I was speaking with you, it's the lack of public transportation, and it leaves a gap for growth in terms of diversity in, I think, both of our counties. The average mean transportation for both of our counties is around 35 minutes, which means that they're not commuting to jobs that are in bigger cities. They're keeping their jobs locally, and in keeping jobs locally, you have jobs that have been white dominated for generations and generations and generations, and that. By that, I mean that it has already been established as a particular field that is, you know, passed down by family, by family, by family. And because of, again, the deep-rooted racism, you attribute both of these factors, and you have a more impoverished community and a more impoverished African-American community, Hispanic particularly in both of our counties, actually. But finally, it's been the suburbanization. And the suburbanization has caused for less low-income housing. And there's no doubt that we want both of our counties to thrive. But the question has to be, what does it mean to thrive if you do not bring others along with you? You know, and I think that there's calls of action for all of these. And I think that we can have different solutions. And I think that everyone's basis can be different on what we can really do. I think that, you know, more public transportation is necessary. I think that more job creation is necessary. One, you know, final interesting point, just so that you can kind of talk about what I just brought up, is the fact that I found it very interesting that the population within Forsyth County, and I believe it might be a percentage point higher for Cherokee County, we have 4% African American population. I think it might be 7% in Cherokee County, but we have a 4% African American population. And out of this 4%, it's all prominent African Americans. And what I mean by this is they are not the typical African American in Forsyth County is not impoverished and actually share similar marriage, dropout, and I think it's financial rates of financial success with their white neighbors. What I mean by this is the dropout rate or the graduation rate for both whites and blacks in Forsyth County is 95%. The marriage rate, I believe, is about, for married and not separated, I think it's only 5% that have been divorced in the county or 15%. And it's the same among both. And then in terms of you know, the unemployment rate, it's about 7% for both communities. So that begs the question, why can we not sustain a high diversity rate while also sustaining a low rate of poverty for those communities?
Right. It's always a challenging subject, and I feel like my ability to comment on it is not to say I'm not going to, but is restrained by the fact that I'm a white man, and my parents were college educated, and so they were very interested in having me go to college, and obviously I ended up becoming an engineer. And that set me on a path to financial strength. And all of that sets me apart in a way. So what I've ended up having to do is try to, because I had interest in it, and because I had spent some time when I was young, my parents were divorced, and I would kind of switch between living with my dad, who's an engineer, and had a upper middle class lifestyle, to live with my mom, who was not an engineer and was living kind of more a low income lifestyle. I joke that I have lived off food stamps, and I have gotten my clothes from the Goodwill, not because it's ironic, but because that's what we could afford. And, you know, and every time I say it, I feel a little like that's so, it's so flippant, really, about the issues that come with poverty. There is a correlation, and I know that it's a back and forth, but it's always been an attempt by the people who have power and wealth to keep people who don't have power and wealth from getting any. Because they are afraid, the people with the power and wealth are afraid that they will be diminished if other people have any wealth or power. And you can see it even in the arguments about MARTA really long time ago, long before I moved to Georgia. But I hear about these discussions where they were thinking about, well, we could run a new line from Five Points to Buckhead. And that never happened, right? It was,
yeah.
They didn't want it to happen. And you've got the same discussions here where we could expand MARTA to where you can get farther than the end of the Northeast line and the end of the North line. You could actually get into Woodstock. You could get into like on the north side, like Johns Creek or somewhere, you know, on rail. And you could fill out the gaps inside the perimeter with better rail. And you could do light rail. But what happens is everyone sees that and they immediately go to all the dog whistle politics about crime will come with, and poverty will come with, and drug use, and all these kinds of things are going to, you know, as soon as you open that MARTA station, why, crime's going to increase by 30%. You know, there are people who, just like we were talking about before, these are not bad people. They have bad information. They believe that when the MARTA station is built, crime is going to spike. They believe that. They never go listen to anybody who can show them that in New York City, they have a very amazing public transportation infrastructure, and it was completely disconnected from crime. And you have it in Washington, D.C. They have a great underground transportation system, great subway. And it's not to say there's not crime in Washington, D.C. and New York City, but it doesn't have anything to do with their public transportation penetration. And I don't know, it's difficult to talk to people about it, because as soon as you challenge them on the idea that crime follows public transportation, like, well, no, that's what so-and-so told me, and that's what I believe, and that's, you know, I have anecdotal stories I can tell about someone who got mugged outside the subway. And it would make, my experience has been that every time that I meet someone from a different culture, from a different background, and I was sort of blessed, didn't know it at the time, but having to live in a low income neighborhoods, living in some, I don't know if it was Section 8, but Section 8 sort of houses, that I learned a lot about just different ways of life, different backgrounds, different histories. And it probably got me to where I am today as far as my political leanings and philosophical leanings and all that sort of thing, is that people are people, and they all have something to contribute, and we all could learn from each other. They could learn from me. I could learn from them, you know. And what you said about diversity is, I was thinking really interestingly, if you like draw a circle around Atlanta that goes out about 25, like 10 miles past the perimeter and drew a circle and just just ignored the little pockets and said, what is in there is incredibly diverse. We've got so much diversity. We've got people from all over the world, and but they're all in little conclaves all over the city, and they stay pretty much to themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that it would help a lot if we had the mixing of cultures and ideas and, you know, food. All that stuff would just, I mean, you can, if you want to get two people together and have them connect with each other, just feed them some good food and they'll, you know, it's no problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you mentioned something that you grew up in a local community, which you had, you know, interactions with people who were different than you, of different skin colors, I believe. They were just different than you. And that's a similar between yourself and a lot of our old guests. For example, Summer Rachel Jackson, the student from MIT, the PhD student, and we have the Stanford professor we had on earlier. They both came from other nations, and they said that really contributed to how accepting they were towards people in general, and how they recognized that it was a fight for all of us. I think that you mentioned that you're different in terms of how you were brought up and how much you've been given. I think that, as we said during the DNC, people said during the DNC, empathy is about putting yourself in somebody else's shoes. And I think that the fact that you recognize that, and the fact that you said in the beginning, it's a fight for all of us. It's not just a fight for a certain race, a certain party, to fight for all of us as Americans. That's really important to consider in our nation. Because I was reading a book yesterday called The New Jim Crow. And I believe they said what happened was that we had poor whites and blacks coming together and fighting for change. I think after the days of slavery. And that's when Jim Crow was really, really pushed, because they didn't want that coalition. It was even during the New Deal. It's because poor whites and black people banded together, and that's where racism was drawn. Those lines were drawn to keep the people in power in power. I think that the main problem in today's world is that we have so much hatred created by that power kind of deficiency. And I think that the point I wanted to mention to you was, we saw a lot of acts go on very recently in terms of discrimination. We had Jacob Blake's incident, where he was shot seven times, in the back by cops for reaching into his car. And we saw Kyle Rittenhouse shoot three people and kill two people during a protest, a riot. And I think that the issue that I saw was that a person who was shot eight times in the back by cops was said as a sex offender, a child molester, a terrible person, and pulled apart by conservative pundits. And conservative pundits said a guy that shot and killed two people who were trying to subdue him after killing somebody else, it was a person they wanted as president, as Ann Coulter put it. It's a very sharp contrast. I think that in terms of what's going on right now, we have to consider this. And I think the two things that I want to talk to you about is, first of all, qualified immunity. Does that need to stay for cops, or what should we do about qualified immunity? Because that's a very emotional thing for myself and Damien. And the second thing is gun laws. I know you're very, very strong on gun laws and how we shouldn't have a lot of these things that we have going on in Georgia. We should have more mandates. I think that's very important to also mention in light of the Kyle Rittenhouse incident. So two things I wanted you to kind of talk about with me and Damien. It's Kyle Rittenhouse and how that affects gun laws and ties back into that. And second of all, qualified immunity and how that affects stuff like Jacob Blake. Off to you.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let me back up to what you were saying about the people with wealth and power trying to drive a wedge between people who don't have it based on artificial divisions. Because I'll just state for the record that all humans are humans, and that there's so little difference between any of the genetic code that makes up a white man or a black man or an Indian man that
you're absolutely good. I get you.
That it's foolish and to the extreme to talk about us as if we're actually separate kinds of people. But I would recommend looking up Thandeka, Thandeka. I don't have this off the top of my head. I looked it up just now. I had read that she looked back and found that in 1705, the Virginia Colony, so this is well before America was founded. The assembly required masters of any servant to give their white servants money, corn, a gun, all kinds of stuff, and reduce the poll tax for them, and didn't do that for any of the black servants. And that was specifically to drive that wedge between the whites and the blacks, to give the white former indentured servants and former white slaves the feeling that they were better, right? And that, right, that's been going on. That's what you're talking about with Jim Crow and the other things, the Homestead Act, the GI Bill, lots of times where they would say that this is for Americans, and then they would implement it for white Americans. And they would just, they wouldn't like, well, we're not gonna do it for black Americans. They just wouldn't do it. Yeah. They didn't like say it, they just didn't do it.
Yeah.
So to talk about guns, I'm happy that Moms Demand Action, they don't do endorsements per se, but they have rated me as a Gun Sense candidate.
Good for you. Congratulations.
I believe that first, the Second Amendment is not really the discussion point. I know that it's really handy for people like the NRA, because it's short and pithy. You say the Second Amendment, you quote a select portion of the Second Amendment, and you know, you're done. That discussion over, I can have all the guns I want. And I think that it's reasonable to say that we ought to be able to protect ourselves, and that it's reasonable to say that I like to go hunting, I enjoy sport shooting, all those things can be totally fine. You can have guns to do those things, and you can own the coolest one that you think, but at the same time, it's reasonable for the society that you're in to say, well, these tools or weapons or whatever you want to call them, and you know, they'll argue about that terminology too. We can also put some good guardrails around how they should be used, where they can be stored, how they can be stored, whether we should license them, how they can be transferred from person to person. And it's always challenging because people feel really strongly about it. There's a lot of family history wrapped up in hunting, especially. You know, someone would go hunting with their dad and uncles every turkey season or deer season or whichever, you know, whatever was the family they liked to go hunting, or all of them, you know. And so they project not only the emotional connection that they have with their family doing that with their family, but also on the tools that they use to have that connection. So they're thinking like, if you do anything that threatens my ability to have a high powered rifle with a 30 round magazine and extras and a heat vision scope and whatever else it is that they want, that is also threatening my ability to have that relationship with my dad or uncles or my mom, aunts, and to develop that relationship with my children, my nieces and nephews, my friends, you know, because there are people who they hook up with their buddies and they go hunting. And I don't have any animosity toward people who like to do that. I think that that's great because they usually care. The people who are really into hunting usually care a lot about the animals that they're hunting. They care a lot about the nature that they're in while they're doing it. They don't want to see people running oil pipelines and pollutants and farm runoff and all that junk into their forest where their prey live, because they need those deer to be healthy and make more deer. But we lose them like immediately when you start talking about, hey, maybe you shouldn't just be able to lay your gun on the porch with all the ammunition scattered about. They get upset, even though that's not who they are. They protect their guns. They keep them safely locked up. They keep their ammunition put away. But you start talking about their guns and locking them up and how their ammunition is, and it scares them, because they're like, well, this is how it starts. And they've got lots of really scary examples of this is how it starts. You know, you start saying, well, okay, you can tell me what to do with this gun and that gun. But at the same time, I think that we could look to Australia for good examples of how you can have a very rich gun culture with lots of good hunting and lots of good sport shooting, but still keep people safe from randos who just, they watched a great movie with a guy with a gun, and the guy with the gun went out and solved a whole bunch of problems just by shooting people up, and think, well, I could do that. And, you know, there's got to be a middle ground where you can hunt and go and show off how great you are with a rifle at 500 yards and whatever else. I mean, there's right down the street from my house every once in a while, they have quick draw competitions. And I think that's amazing. These guys can just like pull the gun and like while it's leaving the holster, they shoot it. They don't even finish putting their arm in. It's just like, that is a skill, you know? Yeah. I'm never going to say all guns are bad. That's not a thing that I believe, because it's not. It's just, there's somewhere in there that we can be reasonable about this.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're right. I think that sometimes I'm scared with the fact that anybody can get a gun off a black market. Anybody can get a gun from even a Walmart. The background check laws are just, they're too little. We can't have anybody having a gun, because it's just, it's just impractical, I believe.
Yeah.
Now, the thing you said about, go ahead.
I hate to go on, but my friend would be very upset with me, because I've had a discussion with him back and forth for years about this. And you mentioned the gun check or the background check, and I just remembered that his suggestion is that the instant background check system is just terrible. It is incredibly underfunded. It's very piecemeal. There's data everywhere that applies to these situations. There's mental health data. There's domestic violence data. There's arrest data that is out there. And it's basically just sitting in a file, ready to go, ready to be entered into the NCIS or NICS.
I think it's NICS, yeah.
It's ready to be entered, and it hasn't been entered. And all they would really have to do is hook some databases together. And there's lots of smart computer scientists out there who know how to hook databases together and have them do their queries and get the data all put together. They're just not spending the money on it. And you could do a lot with creative approaches to that, where maybe we find people who sell guns to people who shouldn't have them, and people who deny, who have like a guy come in and he says, I want a gun, and they do the thing and it says, oh, he probably shouldn't have a gun. And they're like, you can't have one. And they turn him in. They should get some of that money that the other people had to pay in fines. It would be, you know, a lot of these guys, they do it for the money, right? They have a gun shop for the money, and they don't do things illegal just because they just want to get money. But sometimes maybe they aren't as thorough because there's nothing in it for them if they're as thorough as they could be. But if we gave them something for being thorough, and we gave them something for making sure that the guns they sell don't end up in the wrong hands, that would help.
Yeah.
So we have approaches that are not just, oh, well, let's legislate registration. Let's legislate gun locks. Let's legislate magazine size. There's ways that we can do rewarding behaviors to people who do good things, and maybe free gun licenses if you take a gun safety class, or, you know, I mean, there's just all kinds of approaches that we could do.
Yeah, I think that it's very, I was just going to say, I think that it's very interesting, your approach, because I feel like a lot of people, would say that, or I've heard, as opposed to, you know, the reward system, I've heard more of a like punishing, like, oh, you should punish the gun seller if they sell a gun to someone that didn't deserve to have it. Or, you know, with parents, you should. I think that this is something that is up for discussion, that if they, you know, mishandle their guns or put them in areas that they're not supposed to be in, and then that their child goes out and commits a crime with that weapon. You know, I think that maybe, I don't know the solution, but I think that maybe you can incentivize parents to take better care of their guns and to be more responsible gun owners, as opposed to saying that if you're not, we're going to arrest you. But I don't know the practical solution to this. But I think that you were talking about data, and you were talking about how data can be entered into databases. And I think that there's a lot of areas where if we just had the right data, we could understand what's going on a lot more and understand how to deal with things a lot more thoroughly and carefully. And I think that one of those areas is the environment. I think that we're missing a lot of data in when it comes to the environment. And I think that if we had more, a lot more of baseline data in understanding the environment, then we would be able to, again, see the effects that we're really having as people. And you wouldn't have people saying, oh, it's just, you know, it happens every whatever X amount of years. We're not really doing anything.
Solar cycle.
Yeah, exactly. It's a solar cycle. And then you have people saying that they changed it from global warming to climate change because the globe's actually not warming. I've just heard some weird arguments on it. But I think that if we had more data and we could say, this is the fact, I think some people still, you know, there's always going to be people that are just ironically outliers and just won't look at data. But
you're like walking data, man. You're an outlier. That's statistics right there.
Yeah, for real. But I think
Damien,
go ahead. I was just going to say, I was just going to, you know, kind of move into the environment. And that's your little point. So I'll hand it off to you.
Well, I was going to say, Damien, you're out of my mind. Like, that's exactly what I wanted to say. I texted Damien. I was like, I want to talk about something. And that was the environment. Because what got me to talk about in the beginning was the fact that you said that these gun owners, they care about the environment in which their gears are at and how that could affect their hunting and everything else. But these same people, the majority of them don't care about the environment, I think. A lot of these people, like, it's just a complete paradox. I think that, Damien, data is important. But the more important thing is that we have the data about the environment. There's tons of data. And I'm an environmentalist. I'm a very environmentally oriented person. We have the data. The fact of the matter is that people don't want to listen to the data. Same about the coronavirus. In a lot of circumstances, we have the data. It's just people don't want to listen to it. I think that it comes down to changing people's perspectives about the environment and enforcing things. For example, my AP Gov teacher, he's a very active listener to this podcast. He said that under Obama, his neighborhood really, really had guidelines. You know, they had, I guess they had a lot of environmental guidelines, cleaned up places a lot. They had really restringent house guidelines, house by house guidelines. Right. And now the day Trump got elected, they rolled back the guidelines a little bit. And once the EPA just dropped every single guideline they had on neighborhoods, it really rolled back completely. So we're seeing real-time effects of this. The Paris Climate Agreement, the number one chance we had at really repairing this, Trump took us out of. I think that it starts with us preparing for this, and more than preparing for it, I think it starts with us considering it and saying this is what we have to do in this many years. And in Georgia specifically, I wanted to ask you, Mr. Hughes, under Nathan Deal, Georgia's plan for combating climate change, it was one of the most extensive Republican plans. And what that plan was, I'll tell you, it was, and you probably already know, you definitely already know, it was literally preparing for it when it comes. When it comes, this is what we're going to do. But it's almost like missing the whole point. It's going to come and we can stop it. But instead of stopping it, we're saying, here's what we can do as if we're helpless. It's assuming we're helpless, except we're not. As a representative, what would you do for the environment and how we're handling it in Georgia?
Well, I remember that when Trump was pulling out, and I will say that I try not to cast too much of my goals as a state representative in terms of the national politics because it's not helpful.
Yeah,
I think we've gotten too tied up in that. Mm-hmm. Another discussion. I do know that cities and states like California and I think Chicago and New York City and maybe the state of New York, some others said, well, Trump is pulling the U.S. out of the climate accords, but we represent 30% of the U.S. economy. We're going to just go ahead and we're going to follow in them anyway. And that's sort of one of the great aspects that this, the federal system of the United States is kind of interesting because it gives us the opportunity for states to say, nah, I'm not going to do what the federal government says. I'm going to do something else. And you see that with the car emission standards. You know, every car that you buy, almost every car that you buy follows the California car emission standards, because guess what? That's where all the car buyers are. So I feel like the state of Georgia could, it would be difficult given, you know, just after only one election cycle, it would be difficult to say, well, let's commit ourselves to the Paris Climate Accords as a state. And when you're talking about, when Damien was talking about data, and Varun, you're talking about data too, I think that there's a lot that we could learn about the environment that in Georgia that I didn't know. When I sat down, I was like, okay, big issues in Georgia, you know, COVID-19, because I basically started this in March, or maybe right at the end of February. So, it was, you know, let's start a campaign. Oh, let's have a pandemic. So it's so COVID-19, it was great. COVID-19, expanding Medicaid for healthcare. Those were all the big ones that just jumped out at me. But I was thinking, you know, I have always really, like, Earth Day was a big deal for me when I was in school. I really enjoyed Earth Day. My grandmother worked for the state of Tennessee in the conservation department. She would take me to the state parks there. My dad was a Boy Scout, got his Eagle Scout, very connected to nature. I did Boy Scouts for a while, never got that far. I will say that if you ever have the opportunity to meet an Eagle Scout and, like, hire them for a job or something, you should definitely do that, because you'll never regret it. I learned from Patrick Thompson, who's with Greening Georgia, that basically all of the solar that Georgia has in the state that we take credit for having solar as a state is on military bases. So it's the Pentagon. It's not Georgia. It's the Pentagon has said we should have solar power here. And if you think about just in Cherokee County, they have changed recently, or they're thinking about changing one of the big landfills here to accept coal ash, which is some terrible stuff. I didn't really even know about until I started working in the power generation industry as a controls engineer. It's incredibly toxic, and they basically take it and they put it in these kind of holes and their, you know, divots that they dig in the ground, and they line it. I'll say that they do what is necessary as far as they can tell to keep it contained. So they line it with some special liner. But a lot of the time, you know, maybe the civil engineer who did the inspection of the area didn't do a great job, or maybe there's just been a lot more rain than they thought, because there's been a lot more rain for some reason. And in North Carolina, they had one of their ash ponds, they call them, sounds very idyllic. The wall give out, and it basically flooded a community that was downstream of it with this horrible muck that God only knows what kind of health problems people are going to have after that. So I think that as far as getting people on board goes, it's almost never, I don't believe that the environment is important. That's hardly ever their point.
Yeah.
Their point is that they're afraid that if we take this, the same thing as like the first little gun law, they're afraid that the first little environmental law we do, federal agents are going to pull up on their land and they're going to get out their magnifying glasses and they're going to run around and say, oh, I found asbestos, or oh, I found a yellow bellied poisonous skink, and he's one of 50. We have to condemn your land and seize it and turn it into a preserve for this kind of skink.
Yeah.
not because that's that, not because anything like that has ever happened, but because there's farmers or ranchers who have 400 acres of land and the government found 10 and said, oh, look, in these 10 acres, there's this thing that's really special. We should turn it into a preserve. And usually that ends up being like, we're going to pay you for your 10 acres. And, yeah. You know, that gets into eminent domain, which is a whole other messy discussion.
Yeah, to say the least.
We know a lot about it being in law, so.
Okay. Well, they that's the really interesting thing is that it just keeps spearing off into different issues. But I think that, so the thing that I've learned over time, and I hope that I can pass on as time goes on, is that you're not going to find anybody who says, I don't care about the environment. You're going to find people who are afraid that acknowledging that it's important and allowing someone to start the process of regulating it is going to lead to them losing control over their lives in some way. It's always some way of thinking about how they have control over their life. So losing property that they previously had, losing the ability to make money somehow, losing the ability or option to have a certain kind of job or for their family to have a certain kind of business or to go somewhere. It's all about losing. It's a fear of losing control of your life. And a lot of people, that's very important to them. And it's the thing that I feel like we could do better would be to say, I want you to help me. Like, we have this problem. We have climate change. And we can tell you that the climate is changing mainly because humans are putting greenhouse gases into the air. And we can tell you by prediction 30 years ago and by observation today what that's going to do. It's going to make the sea levels go up. Well, I don't live near a coast, so I don't care. Well, it's going to make storms happen more frequently and they're going to be stronger, and it's going to shift weather patterns around, like these polar vortexes that have been coming down. I don't remember having so many strangely cold springs and other weird weather experiences when I was younger 30 years ago as we seem to be having now. And that is what you say, here's the facts. This is what we know. Now, I want you to come to me and gather with all of our neighbors around here, and let's sit down and talk about what will all this mean to us? How will it impact us and our children and our neighbors? And is that what we want?
Yeah.
And stop right there and just have that conversation. Is that what we want to have happen? And then presumably, because I believe that most people are good people, they would say, well, that's not what I want to have happen. Okay, well, then let's talk about how we can stop it from happening. And that's when we start talking about, well, we might have to raise taxes a little bit. Well, I don't want to pay more taxes. Okay, well, we could do, you know, you start having that conversation. Well, if you don't want to pay more taxes, what else could we do? We could have use fees or, you know, let's start talking back and forth. But what, and it's a problem with everybody, right? I walk up to you and say, I found a problem and I know the solution. And the solution is this. And that's almost never, like, that's almost never the final actual answer. Like, even in my work, if I run into a problem, I might have an idea about how to fix it. And, you know, we might say, well, we don't have time to sit down and get everybody in the project together and figure out the solution to this problem. So yours sounds pretty good. Let's do that. But if you're talking about government, if you're talking about changing society, implementing taxes, starting a new huge effort, then yeah, you got to sit down and talk about it. And you got to bring in everybody who is going to be affected. And the first thing you have to do is say, I am agnostic on solution. Let's talk about what we've observed, what we think it means. Ask that question, is that okay? And if it's not okay, then start talking about solutions and say, well, I have a kind of an idea of a solution. What's your idea for a solution? What's your idea for a solution? And all these people who get, who, you know, they, it's unfair. They get characterized as not caring. It's because they feel left out. Like they don't have any control. They don't have any input on this, on the solution.
Yeah.
And that's, you probably heard that. Like I said, I don't like to talk about the national politics, but at the RNC thing, it was all about, these people are going to come and impose things on you with no input from you. And they're just going to make you start doing stuff. And if there's no good argument against that, if you can't say, well, that's no, why don't we, instead of saying, that's not what I'm going to do, psh, you're crazy. The answer is go find the same people they're talking to and say, hey, come here and tell me what you think we should do about this. For, you know, maybe tell me, do you think this is a problem? And if you think it's a problem, what should we do about it? Yeah. You tell me what we should do about it. Yeah. And let's start working together to come up with a solution.
Yeah. And so, you know,
sometimes I'm gonna end on this one.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sometimes people propose problems without solutions, and that's the issue. Because without a solution, there really is no point in trying to make. But go ahead, Damien. That's my last point.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you know, throughout our conversation today, it has become abundantly clear that you are a very common sense politician. I think on every issues you really look at them, you know, you talk, I think you take the engineer approach, where there's kind of, there's a problem and you try to find a reasonable solution. And you know, you look at the logistics of it, and that's how you approach the situation. And I think it's something that we need a lot more of, in the whole country. To be frank. But with that being said, you know, as we do with all our guests, our final question to you is, if you had one saying, thing, message, quote that you could leave to America's youth, what would it be?
First, I'm going to say my opponent is also an engineer. So the people of House District 21 are extremely fortunate that regardless of the outcome of, of this election, they're going to have an engineer representing them. And I think that's great. So I looked back. I have a file. A long time ago, I started doing signatures on my emails. And I was like, man, I got too many. So I just started making a file of all the best signatures. And they're everywhere, all over the place. But thinking back to just over what you were saying about people having different facts and arguing about sort of things, I had one from Sartre that's a little long, but he's talking about anti-Semites, and I want to kind of expand the thought of that, of this quote, to just anyone who is saying things that are false about other groups to try and gin up animosity. So Sartre says, never believe that anti-Semites are completely unaware of the absurdity of their replies. They know that their remarks are frivolous, open to challenge, but they are amusing themselves, for it is their adversary who is obliged to use words responsibly, since he believes in words. The anti-Semites have the right to play. They even like to play with discourse for, by giving ridiculous reasons, they discredit the seriousness of the interlocutors. They delight in acting in bad faith, since they seek not to persuade by sound argument, but to intimidate and disconcert. If you press them too closely, they will abruptly fall silent, loftily indicating by some phrase that the time for argument is past. It is not that they are afraid of being convinced. They fear only to appear ridiculous or to prejudice by their embarrassment, their hope of winning over some third person to their side. If then, as we have been able to observe, the anti-Semite is impervious to reason and to experience, it is not because his conviction is strong. Rather, his conviction is strong because he has chosen, first of all, to be impervious. I'm not that good at speaking, but Sartre, you know,
That was I mean, that was absolutely perfect. Amazing. And it's very, it was, wow. You know, I think there was one name racing through both my and Varun's head, and, you know, it's, you know, it's interesting, but I have to give you the utmost respect, for, you know, complimenting your opponent and being an engineer. And I think that that's something that we're missing. It kind of reminds me of, I mentioned this on the podcast, when John McCain, you know, he was at a town hall and the lady said, you know, I'm scared of Obama being president. And he says, no, ma'am, like, you shouldn't be scared at all. He's a wonderful man. And that's something that we've been missing in politics, I think, I think recently. But with that being said, I want to thank you for coming on the podcast and having an amazing discussion with us. I think Varun wanted to mention one more point, but for me, you know, I think that it was very insightful. I think that you brought a different perspective, and that's really what we try to gauge. We try to gauge, you know, why people are the way that they are and why they think the way that they think. And for that, I have to thank you for bringing us yet another perspective onto the podcast.
Thank you for the amazing conclusion to hand off, Damien. My point was, we always mention at the end of our podcast, have a conversation with anybody, people who are different than you, who are similar to you. Have a conversation, have a political discussion, have that discourse, educated discourse. Today, I encourage our viewers to have conversations about solutions and stop debating the facts, because we have them. Like you said, I think we have to debate solutions and figure out what's the right approach we have to take. You inspired me. I think you inspired Damien as well. And I think we had an amazing conversation today. Thank you all for listening, and have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, everybody.
Hello, 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 everybody. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Politician Podcast. If you enjoyed our conversation, head on over to www.patreon.com/politician podcast for more exclusive members-only content, special episodes, and merch drops. That is, once again, www.patreon.com/politician podcast. I'm going to make it a jingle when I grow up. It is www.patreon.com/politician podcast. No, I'm just kidding, you guys. But definitely visit www.politician podcast.com. For more amazing content from myself, Damien, our team, our amazing artwork head, and our sponsors over at Politician. And once again, thank you so much for watching today's episode. Thank you to my co-host, Damien Galvin, for an amazing conversation, my friend. I do appreciate your input, as always. And that said, have a great rest of your weekend. Chime in for the next episode, and we hope you enjoyed today's conversation.